All right, welcome back to Thinking Religion. It's been a minute, been a while, but I'm excited to be back here with Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
Howdy again, Sam.
Good to see you again. Matthew, give folks a little brief introduction, because we have two completely different contexts here, so it's kind of fun being on one side of the continent, talking to you on the other side of the continent in a separate country for now. hopefully for a long time. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, yeah. So I'm an engineer out here in Vancouver. I grew up in a non-religious family, but I found a love for religious texts when I was a grown-up. I've been in occasional touch with the local Anglican, that would be your guys' Episcopalian cathedral, and have found great nourishment from the writings and the events that I've sampled. But I guess I'm the guy who likes to think religion, but starting as an atheist standpoint. That's pretty much me.
Yeah, and Matthew and I started talking, way back during the Thinking Religion days of Thomas. Matthew had some really great insights. So I've always enjoyed our conversations on email and text and all that good stuff. And it's always fun to be able to have these conversations with you for the podcast as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people know Lamentations, the book in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament or First Testament, however you want to refer to it. And not a lot of people have read Lamentations, but I think it's a fascinating work on so many levels. And I think in the current context here in the United States, at least, there's a lot of connections there. And Matthew brought this up a couple of weeks ago, and we've been meaning to sit down and have a moment to discuss this. So we decided to make this an episode. Matthew, what helped you make that connection between the Book of Lamentations and sort of our current situation politically and spiritually and all those things?
Yeah, so maybe the most, the immediate trigger on my part, sorry, I have to move the cat there out of the way. I remember seeing some articles to the effect that it'll take a generation to recover what Trump has cut, like the various public programs and institutions. And then I saw that about the time that woman, Renee Good, got killed in Minnesota by that ICE officer. And it just really made me think that, well, there's a similarity between what many people in the U.S. are probably doing right now. They're lamenting and they're angry for something they had, but which they do not have now, this constitutional order or whatnot. I'm not sure the legal term. And as a deeply culture-bearing text, I thought, well, this must be, in a small way, analogous. It must be similar, not saying it's the same, must be similar to what many folks in Israel would have been Judah would have been feeling when they were conquered by the Assyrians. And knowing that there are always lessons to learn from the past, especially very emotional experiences, I thought this might be a useful text to consider as we are living in our current moment.
Yeah, and back up for one moment, because it was the Northern Kingdom, Israel, was conquered by the Assyrians, so this would have been the Babylonians.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, you're fine. I have my deep affection for the Assyrians. I've got a statue of Ashurnasirpal Paul II over there. I was trying to reach him, but he's too far away. I love the Assyrians, but yeah, they conquered the more affluent and sort of cosmopolitan Northern Kingdom in, was it 722, according to our best guesses, and this would have been after the Babylonians, and that was around 587 BCE.
586, yeah.
Yeah, so there was generations there of the elites that were kind of taken off to Babylon and then brought back. And I think it's really interesting on that note. We were talking about Jeremiah earlier, but as you said, the Book of Lamentations itself is sort of connected to Jeremiah, and you get this term, the Jeremiads, which used to be used a whole lot, kind of in popular talk. We don't really use the word, you know, Jeremiah anymore all that often. But there's, you know, there's not a whole lot of scholarly consensus around Jeremiah sitting down to write Lamentations, but definitely kind of came out of that tradition. And Jeremiah itself, that conglomeration of a book, is a fascinating whole other can of worms we won't get into today. But for folks who are interested in that, you know, definitely check it out. So this is around, you know, 500 or so BCE. Cyrus the Great has come into power in Babylon, and he's allowed the elite to go back to, and when I say elites, I mean like the priestly class and some of the rulers. He brought in, you know, the guys, the king of Judah and that kind of thing, and his son Jehoiakim, and, you know, those folks who eventually go back. But there was the people of the land that we get in Ezra and Nehemiah that were kind of left there during the captivity. So a lot of times in Sunday schools and that kind of thing, you'll hear that, you know, all of Israel's or all of Judah.
Yeah, that's case, not
uprooted, right?
Right.
Yeah, and the Assyrians were much better than the Babylonians at uprooting people. And that's why we kind of get nothing after the fall of the Northern Kingdom out of, you know, what happened at Samaria and those areas that were kind of in the Amorite dynasty. But in Judah, that's not really the case. You get the people of the land, and they're kind of left there to, you know, live under Babylonian rule. But even Babylon was pretty cosmopolitan about their vassal states. And all that to say, it was a major situation, because not only is the temple destroyed and Jerusalem's in ruins, but all of a sudden now you have this sort of other socioeconomic class coming back if they so choose. Many didn't, and there were still large Jewish populations, right, in Babylon. But for those who came back, you get this mixing and sort of tensions that are, you know, there in Ezra and Nehemiah. And they want to rebuild the temple and have what we call the Second Temple period. But at the same time, they're still dealing with the trauma of Jerusalem falling, which was something that was not supposed to happen. And you get sort of these retroactive looks from the prophets and Amos and Hosea and Micah and Obadiah, you know, the Book of the 12 there, talking about that. So that's why I think Lamentations is so interesting, because it's not really about necessarily the fall, or like in the heat of the battle as Jerusalem's falling or the temple's burning. It's sort of like, what happens
almost kind of a,
yeah, it's after, you know, it's after Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple's burned, political sovereignty is lost, you know, there's theological certainties that have shattered and gone away. So, you know, it's not resistance literature or poetry or Lamentations before a catastrophe, but it's sort of like reconstruction theology after the recovery, you know. So you have this what do we do now type moment, and it kind of lives in that middle space, I think, you know, that I was saying, like, it's what, you know, you described with, I think, in the U.S. here, like, you know, there's definitely a feeling among some groups that, you know, things aren't sort of about to collapse. It's like, oh no, we're in the middle or towards the end of the collapse, and what do we do now? And you know, this has happened, it's come here, especially after, like you said, with the Minneapolis events that are still unfolding, and people are still, you know, being shot and all that kind of stuff. And you know, even here in our little small town, we've had issues with ICE, because ICE moved into Charlotte and they were sending folks down to this area. Yeah, and that was a couple of months ago. But you know, we've had situations at schools where our children go to here, where, you know, all of a sudden a student's not there anymore, and you know, their family has been deported. Yeah, so it's you know, Minneapolis is kind of the flashpoint now, just like Jerusalem would have been, but there's a lot of other stuff happening all throughout the country. So it's, you know, we see the stuff on cable news, but we're not far removed from it at all. And you know, there's constant sort of you know, news alerts like, oh, you know, ICE is on the west side of town, you know, make sure if, you know, you're careful when you go over there kind of a thing. You'll get these little things in Facebook groups and Reddit groups and that kind of stuff. Yeah, so all that's
the limitation sounds a bit like in industry we call it like a lessons learned analysis. So like something's happened, you've recovered from it, you're back up to production, but now you have to like sit down and say, well, why did this happen? You know, and then you have to be like, how can we avoid this happening again? And that sounds a little bit similar to like you're building the second temple now, things have gotten better, but now you have to reflect back and say, well, what exactly happened to cause this disaster that lasted for generations?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's sort of this, you know, even before, you know, Ezra and Nehemiah, you get this sort of personification of the city of Jerusalem and Lamentations, much as we do, you know, here in the current context with the United States. And we talk about Lady Liberty and you know, the idea of our country with the Statue of Liberty and these types of sort of personifications that you know, we ascribe to the U.S. as well, with the eagle and, you know, the sorts of images. And I mean, Lamentations gets right into it. I'm sorry, in chapter one, and I'm reading from the NRS view here. But how lonely sits the city that once was full of people, how like a widow she has become. She that was great among the nations, she that was a princess among the provinces has become a vassal. And, you know, powers remembered, it's not denied, and loss is named without qualification. The city is personified, and, you know, it's not nostalgia necessarily, but it's kind of accurate memory in a way. And I think that's really fascinating to see, you know, how the book hops into that. And you hear that very same language today, you know, and again, social media outlets where people are talking about these things.
I wonder if it's more emotionally affecting, again, like personifying what has happened into like interpersonal relationship type terms, because everyone has experienced the vast bulk of emotions. And so I think it hits more, it's more punchy, it's more potent than if like a future history teacher might say, well, there was a disproportionate military conquest, this or that. That's a little too dry for something which is meant to bear or to continue this culture, right? To signify what has happened.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's, you know, occasionally I'll get that question of where did this thing come from? Like, what does Lamentations mean? Why is that the title of the book? Because it, you know, there's lamenting and we know what that word means, but, you know, how did that become sort of attached? And I think Walter Brueggemann does a very interesting sort of theological take on this in his work on, what was it, The Message of the Psalms? But he's later talking about Lamentations as well in there. And he does some work on Lamentations as well later. But I pulled up this quote. I thought it was really interesting. He says, lament is a mode of speech that keeps faith alive by refusing to lie about the world. So it's sort of this, you know, it's not optimism, it's not loyalty, it's not silence, yeah. It's not ambiguity. Like Lamentation sort of refuses all of that, lament. So I think that's something, you know, if folks dive into Lamentations, they really have to keep in mind, you know, like this isn't a prescription for optimism or action or silence or whatever. It's sort of like this murky liminal space.
I had read just in the background that I think the five chapters of Lamentations, like 22 verses, 22, third one's like a triple size, you know, 66, the others are 22. And that's basically corresponds, I think, to the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, which I think is very, I think it lends an additional poetic meaning. We're doing the Hebrew alphabet equivalent of A to Z on this. And I was wondering, like, if there was to be some iconic American text about this time period. You know, would you have 50 verses or 50 paragraphs or something, you know, one for each of the states in the country at the time that this happened? The obsessive compulsiveness in me does appreciate that little structural detail, maybe, you know, to indicate, you know, we've tried to compress this to meet a certain criterion, as opposed to just, you know, possibly going too long. Just if there's nice symbolicness there.
Yeah, now that's really interesting. Yeah, especially with something like our sort of unconscious, most of the time, sort of reliance on symbols here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, from Washington D.C. all the way down to, you know, our flag, like, which, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, and, you know, the Canadian flag obviously is symbolic, but, you know, the number of stripes and the number of stars and the colors, and, you know, every kid learns these symbols, and this is why we picked the eagle, even though Ben Franklin wanted the national bird to be a turkey, right, which I would have loved. I think that's a much better symbol for us. Not in a derogatory sense. I think, you know, turkeys are amazing creatures. Anyway, that's beside the point. You know, the eagle that connects us back to the Roman Empire and you know, before that to, you know, sort of even more ancient connections there. So I think it's interesting to take that into consideration with that 22 number, you know, in terms of why that was chosen and you know, why that makes it into the final cut. Because, yeah, that's a great point. And that's, I think that goes back to kind of the whole understanding and misunderstanding of Lamentations, because when people do read it, it's kind of like, you know, when we say the Pledge of Allegiance here, you know, at school every morning, you know, we assume that George Washington wrote the Pledge of Allegiance or something, and then you learn, like, oh no, that was written in the early or late 19th century, early 20th century, and really didn't come into favor until almost World War I, because, you know, we were using patriotism to try to unite the country in a way. And, you know, the original salute to the flag was kind of a Nazi salute. And so if you look at early, yeah, if you look at early 20th century school children, children pledging allegiance to the flag, it's the that salute. So then we changed to, you know, hand over the heart. But even what, 10 years ago, President Obama got in trouble because he wasn't, or Bill Clinton, I forgot who it was, they weren't holding their hand over their heart during the national anthem or something like that. And as a kid growing up, I didn't even know that was a thing. And sort of like after a certain time, everyone started doing it. So now when I go to my NASCAR races, everyone's got their hand over their heart during the national anthem. Wow. Yeah, and I'm like, oh, that's a new thing. Like, when did we all agree to adopt that? I mean, not that it's bad, but it's, you know, kind of a strange thing. Why do we sing the national anthem, you know, at NASCAR races or college football games? Right. Not saying it's bad, but I'm curious about that. And it's, you know, I think Lamentations is doing kind of that same work of trying to find that space between the collapse and the rebuilding of sort of bringing people back together. And that's why I was trying to emphasize that not all of Judah was taken over to Babylon. And, you know, there's a lot of socioeconomic tensions like there are today. So I think that's really interesting, because Lamentations does not want to have sort of simple causality, and the text really resists that. So like Lamentations 3, verses 19 through 23, the thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope that the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And I've seen that in bumper stickers and Hallmark type.
Really? Okay.
Slogans. Wow. Just the last part. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Right. And we get the great hymn, you know, great is thy faithfulness out of that. But Lamentations, I would say, pushes back against that because it's like, it's inside ongoing devastation. Like, yeah, Jerusalem's been destroyed, the temple's been burned, but the city is still, you know, in ruins and children are starving. And we get some of that in Ezra and Nehemiah later, even in Lamentations. So hope here is not optimism. You know, it's sort of like survivability. Like, how do we get through? And I think that in our current context, there's a lot of that there because we want to simplify things into slogans and symbols. And we need text and conversations that push back on some of that because, you know, going into the streets is, you know, oftentimes a good thing. And we, you know, I'm a big believer and fan of protests and things about judgment and that kind of thing, of you know, calling out wrongs. But, you know, where's that line of, you know, finding clarity and not just falling too far to the other side of things, which we often tend to do here in the U.S. when we always say the pendulum swings back and forth. Right. So, you know, it's not to sound like a centrist or something, but, you know, or both sides of the argument, but, you know, where is that sort of pushback on both sides? And I don't know, to me, that's kind of the wonderment of Lamentations and why more people don't read it today, I think.
Right. Now, that reminds me of passages I've read in Hindu and Buddhist texts about the need to be able to accept what the current situation is, however uncomfortable, while still having faith or trust, you know, some measure of knowing that, you know, the deities or the nature of the world, you know, still are present, even if your current situation is a very bad one. And so that is, I think maybe that all points in different ways and different religions to this need to, I don't know, have optimism, maybe in human nature, maybe in the ideals of the U.S. Constitution, which are very noble, even as you recognize, you admit that, wow, where I am right now really isn't where I want to be. I think there was a psychologist, Viktor Frankl, I think his name was, had been in the concentration camp, and I think his book was like Life's Search for Meaning. I think he'd made a comment that the people who were able to survive were the ones who were, or more of the people who were able to accept that, I don't know when this will end, but when it ends, I will make it, you know, I will have my life's purpose to do X, Y, Z, including let's not have this happen again. Whereas the people who were hoping that by a certain date they get out, had the most trouble because they kept getting distraught and disappointed. And I wonder if that sort of points again to this realizing that, you know, even if my current situation is terrible, then having some ability to foresee at some other point, you know, these underlying principles or faith or whatnot still exist and still can be reached after we get through this dislocation.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and I think a lot of people feel like that today because I'm so sorry. We're all recovering from the flu down here. I'll edit out that cough. But yeah, so there's, you know, so many people who, you know, want to push quickly to things like abolish ICE or let's impeach Trump. Let's do this, which I wholeheartedly understand. And then there are people that say like, oh, just, you know, be a good citizen and get out of the way and, you know, get out of the street, that kind of thing. And I understand that. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think that what someone like Viktor Frankl is pushing us to, or this text, is trying to find that Buddhist ideal of being in the present moment and understanding, I think, ontologically, like where or why your attention is here and, you know, how you can ethically or morally act after you've sort of allowed yourself the space to have that moment, if that makes sense. So, you know, so many times we want to jump straight to ethics or morality, but I think you have to have an ontology or you know, understanding how the world is appearing to you before you can do that morally. And, you know, with social media and TikTok and all of our terrible algorithms and cable news and those types of things, there's always an agenda trying to push us one way or the other to react, because that's what gets them advertisers, or that's what gets them engagement, or that's what, you know, causes outrage. And we know psychologically outrage is, you know, much more engaging than, you know, agreement. So, you know, if there's anything we've learned over the last 10 years, I hope people take that away and find texts like this to say, okay, well, you know, here's what happened, here's where we are, you know, how am I in this space before I go run into the street and, you know, try to confront a federal officer. And not saying you shouldn't, you know, if that's where you are, but I think that there are always narratives out there that are being pushed on us that we have to wrestle with personally before we can up into a situation. And that kind of requires the slow work of lamenting in a way and giving yourself space to do that. Was it at Kathleen O'Connor at Candler School of Theology at Emory University down nearby here in Atlanta? She reads Lamentations as almost like trauma literature. And it's like a community. And which I really like. And it's like community learning, or a community learning how to speak after collective shock. So when we saw Renee Good being shot in the face, as horrible as it was, it was a complete shock as well. And I remember we were about to walk out to go to church on that Wednesday, I guess a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And I just kind of froze, and I was like, wait, this is, you know, what is this? You know, and your brain kind of takes a moment, and it's, or even just seeing, you know, kind of on the nightly cable news every night, you know, someone being dragged out of their car, or a citizen being tackled in the streets, or shot in the face with pepper spray or whatever. It's like, that's so shocking. And as a community now, we have to learn how to speak almost again, you know, after that shock. Because Lamentations doesn't explain suffering, you know, it sort of accompanies it, and it goes along with that suffering. So it gives language to pain when meaning has been shattered or collapsed. And I think a lot of us are still there, you know, because Christy Noem, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, said last night, evidently, that, you know, there's going to be more sort of these asking for papers to prove your citizenship, and, you know, ICE has free rein to be able to ask for that. And being, you know, 47-year-old guy from the American South, I remember, you know, when the idea of any official asking you for papers, or any official, you know, asking you for your identification here in the United States, was just, you know, absolutely off limits, you know. And even I was telling my wife last night, you know, even back in the day, going to the airport, if you had a ticket, you showed your ticket and you got on the airplane, and anyone could walk right up to the gate, right? Like I remember when you started having to show your ID card. And that was there was a major pushback against that, you know, to get on an airplane. And a lot of that was post 9/11. So that sort of slow boiling over the last 25 years of things like personal rights has been such a, I think, you know, brain shock to so many Americans, because we are, you know, the land of freedom and liberty and personal rights and states' rights and all those things that we claim. But then we see this, and we see, you know, the administration talking about, you know, invading Greenland after we just invaded Venezuela, or, you know, hey, we're going to convince these Canadian provinces to vote to become independent so that they can join the United States, and these weird things that just don't make sense. And Steve Bannon always talks about flooding the zone, and that's really what it feels like, but we don't have language to express kind of that that outrage in so many ways, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I think that that's a really interesting connection with what's happening here in Lamentations.
Yeah, I do remember reading that, I'm not sure if it was still within my lifetime, but whether it was just at the start of my lifetime or just a bit before, Indigenous Canadians, I guess you guys call them American tribes or American Indians, like they, in Canada, they used to have to get a note from some white bureaucrat to be able to leave their reservation, like their assigned place. And so while, I guess settlers, while, you know, immigrant descended people have never had that kind of inconvenience, that was a thing that even my country did not too far from my lifespan, if not, you know, at the very early edge of it, which is something that I think none of us non-Indigenous people ever think about. We've never experienced it, but is kind of horrifying, sort of a hairs on the back of your neck kind of feeling to be like, oh, we used to do this kind of thing. And maybe probably haven't done as good a job of examining those failures that we have committed. All societies do, but that's no reason to excuse them. Like I think it was in the first book, there was the phrase like in the NSVUE that I've got here, it was like the city has sinned against God. And I suppose that was, maybe there's value in not over specifying that too much. I mean, they do have some attributes, but I would bet the people on different parts of the spectrum, the political spectrum, would have different arguments for how things have gotten to this point in the States. Like me being on the left, I would say, well, right wingers have cozied up too much to these people on the extreme fringe in an attempt to, you know, get votes and power. But I'm sure there's an equivalent perspective from the right, which is looking leftwards. Maybe you know, didn't bring enough folks along with you with neoliberalism or whatever it is. And I guess there is value in having one of these culture-bearing documents which explores that and maybe doesn't try to create the official line.
Yeah, that's that's true. And when I describe the U.S., you know, things like IDs and stuff like that, I, you know, definitely should qualify that as, you know, basically white males, because even here, I forgot the year, 71, 72, women were not allowed to get a checking account or credit card in their name?
Yeah, it was somewhere in there. I read that checking account. You couldn't, they needed a male cosigner, which is sort of a power dynamic that really ripe for abuse that we had that in Canada as well. I think it was like 74 where it but like again, that's creeping onto my lifetime.
My mother still has never had a checking account, and you know, she's 60, almost 70. You know, she, you know, worked her way around that for years, so she just never, you know, pursue that. And I think that's so interesting. So yeah, she's got dad's debit card or whatever, and that's what she uses. And I think that, you know, we, again, it's like with the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, we too easily assume from one perspective that, oh, this is the way it's always been. But yes, you know, things like Indigenous cultures here in the U.S. that have had to contend with that. And, you know, even concentration camps on the West Coast for Japanese Americans. You know, we've done this, you know, we've rounded up people and even citizens and segregated them in the name of security. And we're doing that again with ICE detention camps and that kind of thing, where people are being mistreated and dying or being killed, depending on, you know, stuff allegedly, but all sorts of atrocities that again we haven't reckoned with, because there's always this veneer of civilization or this veneer of progress or upward mobility. You know, being here in the American Southeast or the United States Southeast, you know, race relations are you know, always on the front of our minds, and you know, reckoning with the history of slavery and then Jim Crow and the mistreatment of African Americans here, especially in South Carolina, too small to be a republic, too large to be an insane asylum is my favorite description of South Carolina. You know, the having those voices in this conversation, I think, are really important. And when we see someone like Renee Good, being murdered, I think that's kind of a shock, because she's a 37-year-old white female. Mm-hmm. But then we qualify that by saying, oh, but she has a, you know, she's in a lesbian partnership, so therefore she's not mainstream. She probably had pink hair, or she probably did this, you know, all these. Right. So we try to other people that aren't following the rules, and rules that are set up for white males here in so many ways. And, you know, I don't want to sound DEI, but, you know, history is history. And, you know, we can interpolate and read those things. But, you know, our country has a track record of prioritizing one set of people and othering the others so that we can continue that power. And I honestly think that's what's collapsing in so many ways, is kind of that ideal. And it's leading to the rise of not just ICE or Trump, but also things like Nick Fuentes and, you know, kind of the podcast YouTube folks who are pushing, you know, extreme right-wing agendas, you know, borderline fascist type stuff, who are talking about the need for more white children and we're going to lose, you know, our white country or God-fearing country. It's kind of ideal. And we see everyone in the current administration wearing a gold cross. Meanwhile, you know, we're cutting Medicaid, we're cutting, you know, social benefits for families that are struggling. And, you know, I have so many anecdotal stories here from our community that, you know, break my heart. And this wasn't happening 3 years ago. This was happening 2 years ago. And it's just a fascinating moment in time, because I really do think we're kind of like in limitations. We're in that liminal medial space between the collapse and whatever comes next. And again, we don't have that language for it. And that this is my last little thing, because I think so many times on that note, people want to equate America with Jerusalem. Well, you know, America is the new Jerusalem. We've had since the not just the founding of the country, but even the settling of the country by white Europeans. You know, city on a hill, you know, this language. And when I went to Yale, we had Jonathan Edwards College and Jonathan Edwards and, you know, those guys who were preaching, you know, to the communities early on were saying this, and they were sort of promulgating this idea of America as the new ideal that's going to, you know, be this new Jerusalem. And I think so
you guys even invented your own creed almost, right? Like the fundamentals are a sort of agreed upon, I think it's the non-denominational churches are the ones who, if I'm not mistaken, have this particular set of fundamentals that was published in the early 1900s, which I only in the past year realized that's basically, you know, you're setting a new Nicene Creed, kind of. It's like, okay, we're going to affiliate ourselves based on this agreement or this understanding, as opposed to all of the various creeds that have preceded it, as the definitional nuance had to be clarified over the century after century on like, you know, Jesus' nature and other things like that. So yeah, I totally get that. So
yeah,
I mean, that almost gives a backdrop for the America as Jerusalem thing, because, you know, we have the new agreement on what it truly means. That's I don't know, it just it fits, it meshes.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, there's definitely kind of this Protestant, you know, we call it the Protestant ethos, you know, kind of this notion of you know, this place not only being the new world, but also the new chance for European colonizers to sort of create something that had, you know, once been there in Europe, but then all of a sudden, you know, the kings and the church ruined it all. So we're going to come over here and create this rugged individualism of this new religion. And yeah, I mean, I definitely think that there's, and lots of people have done incredible work on this, but, you know, there's definitely kind of this idea of an American religion with, you know, what's the name of the statue on top of the Capitol? It's dressed as a native person. And I think it's Columbia, or Columba, something. It has to do with Columbus. But the statue itself is kind of this deification of that ideal. And there's a replica in the rotunda there that you can see in the Capitol building. But here in South Carolina, our state capital is Columbia, you know? So we kind of fall into that. So it's not Christopher Columbus that gets deified. It's this sort of ideal of what the New World offers to colonizers in that way. And I think, to me, that's why it's so interesting to connect this to Lamentations. And I'm glad we got here with the idea of America as religion, because I think Lamentations offers us a way to, or teaches us how perhaps communities can speak after they realize that their institutions or their, you know, shared cult, or, and I don't mean cult in a bad way, but like, you know, cult as a religion, their institutions can't save them. You know, so how do you speak after you realize that your institution is not going to be the thing that saves you? You know, it's not going to be, you know, the local sheriff. It's not going to be ICE. It's not going to be the president. Whereas for most of my life as a white male, you know, I would look at someone and say, oh, well, that's the president. I'm, you know, I don't like George W. Bush, but I'm going to support him because he's our president. Where I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, I would say. That's important. But, you know, you know, so many people during the Obama administration who I know were right wingers would say, I don't like him, but he's a good president. And now that's broken down, you know, so now Donald Trump bad, whoever runs in 2028 good, or Donald Trump good and whatever Democrat is bad, they're communist or they're this or they're this. And we use those labels to make them something that's not American.
Right.
You know, and I think we haven't grappled with devaluation of those institutions or devaluation of that ideal. And then my last citation here from Lamentations, which I've got in my sort of personal notebook that I keep of, you know, quotes. So if I'm out and about and I'm getting my hair cut or something and I've got 10 minutes, I don't want to pull up my phone and doom scroll on X or Reddit or whatever. I pull up my little book of quotations and read some Cicero or you know, Augustine or something. But this one's in there. I was reminded of this earlier. So Lamentations 4, Lamentations 4. Chapter 4, 1 through 2. How the gold has grown dim, how the pure gold has changed. The holy stones lie scattered at the head of every street. The precious children of Zion, worth their weight in fine gold, how they are reckoned as earthen pots, the work of a potter's hand. And I think about, was it Yeats with the apocalypse, you know, the center cannot hold the winding, you know.
I'm not sure if that was second or,
we're slouching, slouching towards name it. Babylon. The second coming. Yeah, it's second coming. One of my sort of texts I've been going back to a lot these days, but I think that's a devastating image of devaluation. You know, what once mattered is being treated as disposable or as an extractive resource, whether it's our children or our institutions or, you know, our sense of social networks, you know, after the Great Depression and FDR puts in place the New Deal and even voting rights and We saw the overturn of Roe v. Wade, and mm-hmm. you know, there's talk of other things that are coming down the pipe. And I think that that's such a crucial moment for us to say, okay, before we jump to acting ethically or acting morally, what is our ontology? You know, what are we doing here? And that's where I think Lamentations provides mm-hmm. kind of that thing, because Lamentations is dangerous memory, is my last note that I wrote down as I was getting ready here, because I think that that's such a interesting idea. And that was Johann Baptist Metz, I believe, M-E-T-Z. He was a German theologian, and I believe he was Catholic. He was at Munster, I believe, but after the Holocaust, after World War II, he's sort of writing, like, what do we do now as Germans doing theology? Like, how do we recover from this? And I believe he was born in 2019 or something. Anyway, it's pretty recent, but sort of like a Viktor Frankl type from the other side of what do we do? Like, what just happened? And you know, our entire civilization collapsed around us. And right. he talks about Lamentations being this dangerous memory. And I think that that's a interesting idea, because it's a prophecy, you know, and it's in the middle of these prophetical books, and it's attributed to Jeremiah, but it's something else entirely. And it's something that I think we really need right now, which is why I wanted to pick your brain on this, because I think it's such a yeah. fascinating connection.
Yeah. I guess the translation I've got here for verse 3 is, even the jackals offer the breast and nurse their young, but my people has become cruel like the ostriches in the wilderness. And so first off, I would love to know how they came to be aware of ostriches, but I'm sure the imagery, like jackals or sort of scavengers, that kind of, they're, you know, not a noble, you know, high status animal, but the comparison that the people have become cruel, whereas even these low status animals have some degree of care for each other. That makes me think a little bit of the atomization of things, maybe facilitated by mass media, especially by the internet, where previously, in previous decades, for better and often for worse, you had a community you're part of and you're kind of immersed in that. Whereas now it's more choose your own adventure. That's wonderful in many respects, but it can maybe make it easier to other people, because in your set community, maybe you're a Methodist or Presbyterian, whatever, then you would inherently encounter people with a variety of views. It'd be like TV before they used to have like an equal time rule, kind of. You couldn't have like
the
junior on unless you also had like, I don't know, Noam Chomsky on occasionally or something. But that's a guardrail, maybe, in some cases, where you would realize that, you know, there are smart people who have disagreements and they can still be human beings, respectable people. Whereas when that rule was removed from TV, and now, like, I don't watch a balanced set of YouTube streamers, I watch people of a particular orientation, then that is the become cruel like those ostriches that they reference. But
that's a great point, because we all think that we're so immune to being influenced like that. But if all you listen to is Joe Rogan, you're going to have a certain perspective. Or if all you listen to is Bill Maher, you're going to have a certain perspective. And yeah, if your social media feed is filled with, you know, your TikTok feed is filled with people, you know, getting hurt, or your Instagram feed or whatever, you're going to think a certain way. And that's why I think this is so dangerous for children. But we all think we're immune to that. It's like, no, I'm a smart and capable person. There's no way. And it's like, no, you're not. None of us are. We're all susceptible to that. And we've all been sort of pushed by those algorithms.
I think there's a Richard Feynman, famous physicist, saying along those lines, I'm going to paraphrase, it's like, you know, it's easy to deceive foolish people, and then the most foolish person is always yourself. It was, I totally mangled that. That would be one of these, you know, garbled translations that get over the years, but you would think that people with higher, you know, higher degrees of education or something might be less susceptible to blind spots. But there are many studies which show it's not true. In their little area of focus, they might have a slight reduced blind spot, but we're all beginners in 99.9% of life. So there's an advantage to being humble about one's expertise.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what, you know, Plato said about Socrates, you know, it's wisdom is knowing what you don't know, basically, you know, and then realizing you know nothing about nothing. And yeah. That de-anthropomorphizing, I can't talk today, of the cosmos, and realizing, no, the Earth is not at the center of the universe. The Earth is not at the center of the solar system. And, you know, the United States is not at the center of the world. But those are all earth-shattering moments for lots of people. And people were killed and burned at the stake. And now we look back and say, oh, how could people think that, you know, the Earth was at the center of the cosmos? And, you know, through Ptolemy, there's some good points he makes. But all it takes is one guy looking at, or a person looking at Jupiter and saying, hey, there's things going around Jupiter that are orbiting that planet. Like, wait a minute, you know, how does that work? And, you know, like exactly what you're saying, I think that we want to defend our side so hard, you know, whether it's, you know, Trump on one side, or, you know, Macron if you're in France, or you know, Trudeau, or AOC, or whoever your political person of choice. You want to defend them so much, and when, you know, you kind of get pushed on these things, you identify with that side because that's where your allegiance is. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the important work that Lamentations still does, is like, there's no defense of God here. You know, there's no, oh, well, you know, get out of the street, citizen, if you're being a good American. It's, there's none of that sort of defense of God or Trump or AOC or anything. You know, it's just sort of saying, here's where we are, like you were saying with kind of the Buddhist tenet there. And lament doesn't justify suffering, but it keeps company with it in a way that makes us all uncomfortable, because we don't know how to keep company with suffering in our world today, because we have so many dopamine hits, you know, from our phones to video games and all those things. And that's really hard work. And that has to be done at the individual level in order to get to the community level, I think. But, you know.
Cathartic, maybe. Maybe is that the word? Catharsis.
Or yeah, catharsis.
Something. It's a, it may have been a helpful text to process what is going on, to help surface the things that need to be surfaced, even if it doesn't offer the, even if it doesn't know the prescription in each particular case.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, there's no resolution. There's no rebuilt temple. There's no answered prayers. The kids are starving or getting eaten by jackals or ostriches. I think there were, I know there were lions early on, but I think there were large birds in Palestine. I need to go back and, I did some research into that way back. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, not to delete that important moment, but there's no resolution. There's no rebuilt temple. Like, you know, lament is what faithful and I would say right-pointed communities do when they refuse despair and denial, you know? So it's, again, that middle ground. And it's, to me, like a discipline of staying present to what is broken without pretending that we know how it's going to be fixed or healed. Because we don't know how this is going to work out. And I have 5 children and pray every night, like, let's figure this out, because I've got an 18-year-old and I have a 2.5-year-old. And that poor 18-year-old is going out into all of this, and she's amazing and, you know, it'll be fine. But, you know, I think back when I was 18 in the year, 1997, and the world was completely different. And the world was my oyster, and I could travel to Europe and just have, you know, my passport, or I could go to Canada with a driver's license, and there was none of this, you know, and I could freely let people know I was an American in Europe without fearing You know, and now when she travels, she's like, I'm going to put a Canadian patch on my bag. I'm like, oh,
right.
That's horrible. You know, so it's like, there's no push for this either. And that's mm-hmm. the hard part for me. You know, and I want people to be in this moment because it is shocking, but before we react, let's be here and let's do the hard work of lament so that, mm-hmm. as you said earlier, we don't do this again, you know,
right.
I don't know. I'm still kind of in that shock mode that, you know, entered when I saw that shooting on TV. Or, you know, I heard a story about a child here, just a couple of miles away and their parents and deportation and stuff. And it's shocking, you know, and you don't know what to say or do. And this is a good reminder for me personally to attend to that discipline of staying present to what's broken.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, that's it for me as well, then, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew. I think more people need to hear that and talk about it. And I always appreciate your input. You definitely helped me sort through things over the years. So thank you for your insight.
Okay. Well, thanks. The feeling is much reciprocated. So,
yeah. And Matthew's got some exciting stuff happening in the coming months, and we'll be
say more about that as it comes, comes further.
Yeah. So. Stay tuned for that. It's going to be fun. But thank you, Matthew.
Yep. Thanks, Sam.